Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Tibby Weiler is a second-generation winemaker who thought of becoming a doctor, chose to join the business created by his pioneering father Aldo instead. Our fascinating chat covered what he calls the tiramisu of Barolo's soils, the best way to handle Nebbiolo in the vineyard and winery, his love of ugly duckling grapes like Dolcetto, and why organic farming enables the winery to get the best out of its terroir. Hi, Giuseppe, and welcome to the podcast.
Buongiorno, team.
It's so nice to hear your voice, and you're in Barolo, aren't you, lucky man?
We are. It's been a great day, sunny day, warm, really kind of a May, as May should be.
Well, listen, thanks for joining us, especially on a Sunday. I want to deep dive into the family, this amazing family, because you're only second generation, and people think of Weiler as being an old winery, but it's actually not that old, is it? I mean, tell us a bit about your grandfather, because Giuseppe Domenico Weiler, the estate's named after him, and he worked in the Ministry of Defense, but he'd inherited some vineyards. Tell us a bit more about your granddad.
Absolutely. Yeah, indeed. We are second generation, and the winery name, GD, comes straight from my grandfather's name, who did not make wine, but he's the man who sort of entrusted his son, my father Aldo, then a very young kid with his trust and like signing into the bank loans and the permits at an age where my dad was just under legal age and would have not been able to. And so it was a sign of gratitude for Aldo to sort of name the winery after his father. And sometimes he was so young, he wouldn't get credit, you know, when he had to do some purchases for the winery. So to go in with the name of his dad was sort of giving him the backup needed.
I mean, he started at an unbelievably young age, didn't he? Your dad was brought up in the city of Turin, but he had this kind of affinity with the land. And there's a lovely picture on your website of him with a lamb in his hands. I mean, how did he end up as a contadino or a peasant, as we'd say in English?
Well, we posted that picture of him with the lamb because I think it really portrays his passion for farming and nature and the animals at an age of a kid. But it was when he was 15 years old, he got into some serious troubles. He started protesting against the status quo and the war. And with having a father working in the Ministry of Defense, it was not really a smart idea. So he was sent back to the farm to spend the summer, a bit of a punishment, away from troubles in the middle of nowhere, just working hard with the sharecroppers that were running the farm back then. And it was through that summer of 68, he felt in love to that life and decided he wanted to become a farmer. So pretty much the only kid of his generation who chose to become un contadino.
So everybody else was leaving the land and going to the city, right?
Correct. You stayed if you had no options. And don't get me wrong, there were people with immense passion in his generation, but you had to be born at the farm to be there, unless you were called Aldo Weiler. This is for the little neck of the woods where we are.
And he was demonstrating outside the Ministry of Defense, which was where your grandfather was working. Which war was he demonstrating against? In the 68 Vietnam War or what?
Tim, I'm still wondering if it was the boldest or dumbest move of my father's life ever, but I don't think I'll have an answer to that. Yeah, I think it was really the beginning of the youth political protests. So yeah, there was certainly a connection to what was going on in the United States and Vietnam, but I think it was sort of getting also a political sense, right? Italy was not involved in wars at the time. It was more about the youth trying to change course of action.
And I love it that your dad was 15, right?
He was 15. So he was even young for that, right? Yeah. Most of that generation was slightly older. But
I mean, your dad is a wonderful person and a great character, and I'm delighted you're still making wine with him. Just tell us about this vineyard then. So he was sent by your father, by your grandfather, to this vineyard where there were sharecroppers. How big was the vineyard and where was it? Was it in Barolo?
Well, yes, it is. We are in Barolo. We are in the small hamlet called Vernie, which sits on the top of a hill just west of the village itself. And the farm had been given to sharecroppers in 1948 when my grandparents moved to Torino. At the time, there were 7.62 hectares of land, but only 0.3 hectares of vineyard were left. And it was around the time my dad came back, he started to replant. So it was a minuscule vineyard. Like, it's crazy to think that was enough.
And what was the rest of it? Just empty land? Was it grazing land or?
Fields. We had some cattle, some cereals. It was a real Piemontese farm. Mm.
And do you still have that 0.3 vineyard, the original 0.3 hectare vineyard?
Absolutely. And we cherish it a lot. It was a Dolcetto vineyard. And then the first parcels my dad planted were Nebbiolos. But we still have that vineyard. We call it Vigna dei Nonni, the vineyard of the grandparents, because it came from the previous generation.
And so what did he start planting? He started planting Nebbiolo? I mean, you've got everything on that. We'll talk about that later. But you've got lots of things, haven't you, on the farm?
The first two blocks were two Nebbiolo vineyards, one in Brico delle Viole and one in Fossati, which is on the way from Barolo Vergne on the way to La Mora, so slightly more to the northeast from the farm. These were the two first parcels he planted. And I think since then, it was a continuous progression. And, you know, we love all the local grapes, so there was not really just one focus, but it was more about trying to understand which grape would fit best on each land.
Interesting. I mean, against the wishes of his parents, your grandparents, Aldo, your father, studied viticulture and enology. And that was where he met Francesco Garofalo, yeah, who had a huge impact on him, didn't he? But he was a professor,
yes,
wasn't he? Yeah.
He was a professor. He was a professor of ecologia agraria, which, for lack of a better translation, it would be sort of organic farming, as we would call it today. And when my dad started to tell us about this guy, Garofalo, I started to try and sort of dig for more information. It was actually hard, but it's amazing. It's amazing the sort of the belief and the drive this professor had. Now, there's a funny story of how he would gather a few students who were into the concept of organic farming to discuss after lesson hours. And they had to close the door of his office because all the bills of the faculty were paid by chemical companies and mechanical companies. And so talking organic farming back in those early days was not really the flavor of today. So they better shut the door. And it was like a bit of a, we would say, Gruppo Carbonaro. It was like a bit of a dodgy, naughty, hidden group of fox.
I like Gruppo Carbonaro. It's brilliant. Yeah, and so this was when was your dad there at university? The early 1970s, would this have been?
Yes. It was the only chance for him to get permission to start farming the land was if he would sign for a college education. And clearly, he had no doubt, if he had to go to college, he had no doubt about which faculty he would have chosen. So it was early 70s, all the way up to 1976, I think, is when he... imagine he was sort of splitting his life, going back and forth, commuting between the farm and the university. So it was a bit of a long, longish course of lessons for him. And and then he became the only farmer with a PhD in viticulture in his pocket. And that was quite interesting.
And how far is it from where you are in Barolo to Torino, to Turin? An hour and a half, maybe?
1 hour today. But back in those days... Forget the highway. It hadn't been built yet. It wouldn't have been easily 1 hour and a half or a train commute. And then if you were really lucky, you would get a lift. And otherwise, it was about 3 miles walking up the hill to get to the farm.
Wow. And so he started with organic viticulture in 71, yeah, and made his first wines in 72. And that was a Dolcetto, was it, in the first wine he made?
Well, I actually recently asked him, which designation, how did you sell your 72 wine? I was basically sold as a vino rosso da tavola, a red table wine. I'm sure some people that will hear us know this, but don't buy 72 Barolos and Barbaresco online, because 72 is actually possibly the worst vintage of the century in Piemonte. So it was not even allowed to produce Barolo and Barbaresco. It was his first trial. He says, luckily, my friends drank it all before the following summer. But we still think of 72 with love because it was the trigger for him to sort of step into the winemaking side of things.
but he didn't have any Nebbiolo anyway. Was he buying grapes, Nebbiolo grapes?
No, that table, that was made with the Dolcetto, and the Nebbiolo vineyards by then were already yielding some fruit. So it was already some of our very young vineyards of Nebbiolo then.
So he planted those, what, in 1960, 68, 69?
68, yeah, just about 68, 69. So 72
when he was
is really 15.
He was 15 years old. Well, it's an unbelievable story, don't you think?
It is. It is amazing. Yeah. I'm tempted to go farther, but yeah, I think it's just amazing when you hear him talking about those early days. He had to learn it all. Growing in the city, he had no sense for farming in a way. He had love for farming, but he didn't have common sense of someone who had been grown in a farm. And just out of passion and I guess also a drive, he would just beg farmers to teach him. He would go and work and help just for the sake of seeing the job and learning the job. They're quite amazing.
Best way to learn, maybe, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, how did he acquire vineyards? I mean, presumably land was much cheaper in those days than it is now. I mean, Barolo has got seriously expensive. And I think you told me once that the in 86 there was a very bad frost, wasn't there? So a lot of people were forced to sell vineyards. But he was already buying vineyards before that, presumably.
Yes, I would say this, Tim. Maybe it's the first time I tried to phrase this as neatly. I think part of the passion of vineyards and the chance of farming vineyards came absolutely with his passion for farming. But also in those early days, it was really hard for him to get started, to get the confidence of people, to get the trust and respect. It's something that came over the years. For us, it's always an amazing honor when an older farmer asks to take over his vineyard. We might say yes or we might say no according to how we like the vineyard. But the fact alone that you're asked is a great honor in the farming culture where we come from. And but again, think about this very young kid who's getting started, who doesn't even speak a fluent Piedmontese, which was like the language you had to know to talk to the locals. And it was not easy. So I think that is also a trigger for this understanding of how special it is to farm a vineyard. But indeed, as you mentioned, it was different days. Farms were very different and many people were seeking it out. So it was actually for him a great chance to start. And then 86, it was a very strong turning point, right? So 86, we had this incredible heavy hailstorm. It was May 29th.
Was it, hail, not frost, was it? It was frost.
It was a hail, correct.
Hail, right, okay, yeah.
Just to give you an image of the magnitude of the damage, Battista Rinaldi, the father of Giuseppe, the grandfather of Marta and Carlotta, ripped out one of his parcels after that hailstorm. It hit so bad that some people just saw too much damage in their own vineyards. And a whole generation of older farmers felt it was like the straw that broke camel's back.
And they sold their vineyards.
They were out. The perspective of thinking your children were not continuing, you would have to farm 2 years with very scarce results. That vintage was gone. But even 87 would have been harmed by the severity of the hailstorm. They just had it enough. And that was a moment when many came and saw him. They were asking, Aldo, what are you going to do? And he was like, he was a bit naive at first. He would say, oh, I'm going to prune the vines again. He thought that they were seeking for viticultural advice. And they were like, no, Aldo, we might not have a degree, but we know what to do in the vineyards. What are you going to do in your life? Yeah. And he was like, well, I'm staying. They were surprised. They thought this guy with a degree, he was at the time, he was still teaching as a viticultural professor, which was a nice way to sort of make ends meet. And they thought he would be out. And the fact he wanted to stay, they would go back and tell him, Aldo, if you stay, take my vineyard. So it was quite an incredible moment. And it all happened very, very soon. And Aldo was like, guys, I have no money, you know, I'm in your same situation. I'm not going to be able to harvest. But it was a different era, perhaps, in that people were...
They trusted him. Yeah.
were at peace with it, to give him some terms. And so we were able to get going.
And how many hectares do you have now?
Today is about 80 hectares.
80, yeah.
Yeah, we see these as, there's many ways to see it, but we feel we are a family of six working together with an amazing team. Is a size that, yes, make us work very hard, especially these days. Isidoro, my brother, who's the viticultural manager, is really on the summer rhythm, which is intense, but is also a very delightful group of vineyards. And we feel the joy of every single parcel.
Amazing. You've gone from 0.3 of a hectare in 1968 to 80 hectares now in 2024. You could have studied medicine or liberal arts. Instead, you studied viticulture and winemaking. What made you change your mind? Was it just seeing what your dad was building in the business?
Well, I had my start in the vineyards and in the cellar at the age of 15. Apparently, I was playing too much soccer. They sent me out to work one morning at 6 a.m. with the team because they had enough of a kid lost in the soccer field all summer long. And that's how I started. But our parents were very special, and they always made a point of letting us free, which was not a given. So we were able to grow with interests and passions and dreams. And my turning point was medicine. I had passed the exam to go medical school or viticulture. And I knew if I was to join the family, I wanted to study viticulture and winemaking. I wanted to make a difference in the craft. The business side of things was not really my primary interest. But I was really twisted, and it's big decisions are hard to take for me. Like, I was thinking and going nowhere. So the last night before I had to show at the university and sign myself somewhere, I asked my father, "Papa, what is the social sense of your job?" I feel like I heard the longest silence from him ever that moment. It was maybe just a few seconds, but it felt like it was gone forever. And many years later, he told me, he admitted, "Giuseppe, that night I had no answer for you.
Yeah.
I chose this job because I loved nature, I loved the tractors." But in that very moment, after the silence, he got inspired by a painting and said, "But look at that painting." Well, first he said, "Giuseppe, if you want to save lives, go be a doctor, because we don't really save lives with wine. But look at that painting. We don't need it to live. So as we don't need poetry and music to live. But what would be life without beauty?" And that angle, it was something I had perhaps lived and somewhat perceived throughout my life, but never explicitly. So the idea...
And he articulated it, yeah?
Yeah. So the idea that we could make a difference in the beauty was intangible, but was somewhat of an answer to my desire to have a social sense of what we're
doing. I think he told you the right thing. Listen, give us a very quick overview of Barolo. How many villages are there? You know, where is it in Italy, and what are the major influences? I mean, some people have been lucky enough to have been there, including me. It's unbelievably beautiful, but some people won't have been there. And I hope after they listen to this podcast, they'll think, "Shit, I want to go there. I'm going to Turin or Milan. I'm going to go and hire a car and go there."
That'd be fantastic. Listen, it's a beautiful land. It's a small area. It's made of 11 villages. But once you get on top of a bit of a secret hill where we'll be happy to bring you, you can see the entire Barolo region in front of your eyes. So it's tiny. It's maybe 3 miles as a crow flies east to west and about 6 miles north to south. It's folded like a nice napkin that is delicately folded in two valleys. There's kind of two valleys, the Eastern Valley, which I like to call the Saravanian one, and this Tortonian Valley, which is to the west. It's embraced by the Alps. When the sky is clear, we have a blue sky, you can feel and you can see the Alps, the range, hugging the region, surrounding it on three sides. I like to call the region also a battlefield, because when you look at the climate, we are right in between the Mediterranean weather, trying to make a push north from Liguria and the Mediterranean Sea. And on the opposite direction, we have sort of the cold continental weather from Swiss and France, trying to break through the Alps and coming down and landing on our heels. So it's a clash of these very different weathers. And I think that's part of what makes Barolo special is it's not easy, right? It's not a given that we have a nice day of weather. But somewhat, the grapes that were selected and that thrive today, one of their features, one of their qualities was the ability to express personality through this challenge of weather. So tiny region.
Yeah, in that place. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say one more element for people who might have visited, say, Tuscany and never been up to Piemonte, is going to be different landscape, right? In Tuscany, you have gorgeous vineyards, gorgeous landscapes, but everything is spread out. Barolo is such a tiny land. When you're in the middle of it, it feels tight. It feels concentrated. And 5 minutes drive, you're out of it. It's like a little dot in space, which is an amazing garden.
And just tell us briefly about the soils. You've talked about these two valleys, an eastern valley and a western valley. And you've referred to the soils, and I like the image a lot, as a tiramisu. Why is it a tiramisu? Because the soils change from west to east or east to west, depending on which way you start, where you start.
Well, I guess you don't have to have made a tiramisu in your life, as long as you've tasted one, to understand that tiramisu is all about the art of sedimentation, just as the soils of Barolo. Is a sedimentation of layers that have been sort of put together one over the other over millions of years. At the time, it portrayed Piemonte as a tropical sea. The only element emerging from the sea were the Alps. And the more they were rising, the more they would crumble and create sediments that would fall into this very hot water, capture shelf life. That's why the soils are calcareous soils and layer. Okay, so that's
the shells, the old shells that were in the base bottom of the ocean, yeah?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's how the sedimentation happened. But when you look at a tiramisu, just as much as when you look at sedimented soil, it tends to be horizontal layers. Mm. Now, what happened is that these soils tilted, and that's why I like to call it the tiramisu accident, they tilted sideways so that what we notice today is going from the southeast to the northwest, we see the soils by age group. So in Serra Lunga, which would be the southeast village of Barolo, we see the oldest soil emerging to the top. Kind of the bottom of tiramisu has been lifted up in that area. And the crust, the topping of the tiramisu, has collapsed on the northwest, which would be past Verduno and La Morra, in the back of La Morra.
And close so where you are in Barolo, really, yeah?
Close, but very different soil, because we're really on two different layers of this tiramisu.
Yeah.
So this, I hope it makes sense, but this is why the tiramisu accident.
And you get very different styles, don't you, from obviously from all the different villages, but particularly from that sort of western side and the eastern side, there's almost a dividing line. Tell us about the styles. One is a bit more powerful than the other, isn't it?
It is indeed. I would say to understand that it's a matter of soils, as we discussed, but it's also, and just to reaffirm the concept, the east side of Barolo is where the soils are the oldest, right? And as you progress to the west, you have slightly younger soils. But it's also a matter of microclimate, because the more eastern you go, the farther away you are from the river Tanaro, and the more west you go, the closer you get to the river. So you also have a mitigation factor that has an important role in the style of the wines. And the third and last point, there will be many other details, but the third and last is the amount of iron. As we go to the south towards Monforte d'Alba, we find more iron in the ground, which would sort of give more of a kick to the tannins. And as we progress to the north, especially La Morra and Verduna, we have a lack of iron and those kind of a softer style of wines. So when you look at the wines on the east side of the Barolo area, from Serra Lunga especially, what prevails is the old calcareous soils and the very austere kind of climate, the quite dramatic conditions that would sort of lead into this very broad style of wines with very subtle, elegant tannins, but intense tannins. As you go south towards Monforte, that's where you get the kick of the iron.
Yeah.
And you get a bit more of the punch of the grip, Barolo.
The grip of regular tannins, yeah.
I kind of compare it to a distortion pedal on an electric guitar, right? When you have the iron, the sound changes.
Oh, I like that, yeah. Just tell us about your winemaking style, because you once told in an interview that there's nothing we can create in the cellar. Now, is that true? I mean, you know, you're obviously working in the cellar and you've got stainless steel. on the one hand, but you've also got Botti Grandi, the Slavonian oak food draw casks. Just tell us a bit about the winemaking style. What are you trying to achieve in the cellar? I mean, nothing, it sounds like it.
Well, in a silly, if you will, metaphor, just think about how many possibilities we have today on cell phone cameras, right? Today, everyone has a camera on his cell phone, and all these cameras have plenty of filters. Mm. But I think there is a special satisfaction when you take a great picture without using the filters. Mm. And that, in essence, would be what we try to do with our winemaking. It would be a portrait of the grape, of the vintage, of the variety, of the site, without the use of filters. So now, that doesn't mean we don't care about winemaking or we don't care about know-how and tradition. It's actually quite the opposite. But try to use all of the wisdom that has been accumulated through tradition and science in a way that it doesn't interfere with the voice we care the most. And yeah. The voice we care the most is the song of the grape, is the song of the vineyard.
It's interesting. I mean, your distortion thing, because in the 90s, with the rise of the Barolo boys and lots of people using new French barrique, you know, and there was this sort of war, really, between modernizers and traditionists and all those things. Maybe those were filters. Do you think that the wood that was put onto those wines and some of the late picking and stuff like that, an extraction of color, and maybe the addition of other grapes? We can't say that, but it might have happened too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But and I would like to say this with huge respect for the Barolo boys. It's a different story from the story of Vaira, but it's a story for which we have respect. And it was a generation that was trying to get out, dig ourselves out of all the misery of the 60s and 70s, right? So they did what they could. But for sure, to the point of filters, when oak becomes prevailing, when oak takes over the flavor wine, that is a filter. Mm-hmm. Just as much as the lack of hygiene in a cellar is a filter.
Yeah.
So the contrast between the early modern days and the traditional wines made back in the 80s was actually also a contrast between a bit, apologies, maybe the word is not really correct, but a bit of funkiness you would find into the more traditional school versus these early modern wines, which are very neat. Mm-hmm. It was then the excess of use of oak that kind of created a filter. Yeah. So I always feel you have to beware of filters in both ways. It's a pendulum. Mm-hmm. You can have an excess in one way or the opposite way. It's a tricky but very exciting balance that we're trying to see.
I love the way you put that. It's extremely eloquent. And I think I agree completely. I mean, not just because I agree with you. I think you're correct. Well, I do, you know, but I think it's very, very well put. You know, that some of the very traditional style was a bit too funky. Some of the very modern style was too oaky, but there's a path in the middle. And I kind of think that's where Barolo is today, isn't it? I mean, you never hear people talking about tradition and modernizers in the same way as they do.
Absolutely. And listen, if I may express a personal belief, I like to think of those days, the 80s and 90s, as the teenage of our region.
Yeah, I like that.
Because I feel that there was a lot of excessive success or perception or a pampering in the early days. And now there's almost a sense of disrespect sometimes for the work of the Barolo boys and the modernists. Mm. But when I look at those 20 years as a teenage, and I think everyone that has been a teenager, you know, sometimes you do the wrong thing, right? Sometimes you go a little too far. Sometimes you regret something you've done. But everything is so useful and needed to grow up and learn who you really are. Mm. So I feel those 20 years being a teenage to the region allowed us to touch boundaries, to maybe go excessive ways, but they were incredibly useful. And if today, I think Barolo has stepped up to another level, to a higher level, is thanks to all the trials and all the learning that was accumulated through those 80s and 90s.
Yeah, it's like somebody doing too many illegal drugs. We shouldn't say that, but anyway. I mean, as well as Nebbiolo, which we'll talk about in a minute, you work with lots of other Piemontese red varieties, you know, Dolcetto, Barbera, Fraser. You call these heirloom varieties or sometimes ugly ducklings, but you love them, don't you?
We absolutely love them. And in fact, the ugly duckling expression came as a perception. I was in Melbourne, Australia for a masterclass. I was very, very young. And I was sent as perhaps the oldest of the family who would speak English. I remember my legs were shaking underneath the table, and I was talking with two of the most famous winemakers of the region. And one of them led the conversation by saying Nebbiolo was the king of Piemonte. This was a bit cliche from those days. And Barbera was the queen. And I was waiting for a metaphor on Dolcetto that never came. That's when I sort of started thinking, well, Dolcetto must really be an ugly duckling if there is not even a metaphor for the grape. We do love them. We do believe they are part of the roots of Piemonte. And we just care about honoring as much of this diversity and heritage of the region as we can.
Because how much of your 80 hectares would be Nebbiolo?
About one third. So it's about 25 hectares. And then we have approximately the same surface as Dolcetto and Barbera. Mm. So combined, these three grapes would represent about 90% of the vineyard holdings. But then we have Fresa. We've recently planted Zlarina and Chatis, which are two incredibly obscure grapes from the past of the region. We love pampering this diversity.
And you make one of Italy's best Rieslings as well. Red grape is a white grape, I know. But
we were children. We were sent to hide those bottles whenever French or German visitors were booking a visit at the winery because we felt too ashamed to show our Riesling bottles. But indeed, it was the first ever planted in Piemonte in 1985 and always was just a flag to say our immense love for Riesling.
And you make, what, six different Nebbiolos, I think, including a sparkling Nebbiolo, don't you?
Yeah, it might be a little more than that, but we have five single vineyard Barolos. Mm. We have two communal Barolos, which would be Barolo Albe from the village of Barolo and Barolo del Comune di Serralunga from Serralunga, clearly. Then we have two Lange Nebbiolos, one which would be sort of a more classic style and one as an inspiration from the 1600s. And then the sparkling Nebbiolo, the Nostra Signora della Neve, and a small production of Rosa Bella, which is a rosé based on Nebbiolo.
So I make that 11, is that right?
Yeah.
That's a lot of Nebbiolo. Just tell us how you get the best out of it. I know that you guys favour long macerations, and it's a bit counterintuitive. You would think, anybody listening, if you do a longer maceration, like if you macerate a tea bag in hot water for longer, you extract more tannin. But longer macerations seem to give you finer tannin, certainly.
Very little about Nebbiolo is intuitive, and a lot of about it is counterintuitive. So I think it comes with the variety. Nebbiolo is tricky starting from the challenges of the ripening. It's the earliest grape that goes through bud break and the last we're going to pick. So historically, it was a matter of risk management for farmers. It was hard to get Nebbiolo ripe. Secondly, it has a very fragile stem. And what is incredibly hard to figure is the stem behavior always varies with the vintage. So it's really a function of every season, every vintage. Third, it has so these fragile stems impact into the way we work as we have decided over the years to actually triple sort all the fruit by hand, just for the sake of making sure that if we are destemming the fruit, it is really well destemmed. Because the worst that can happen is to actually have little jacks and little pieces of stem going into the fruit, and they will give some sort of rougher tannins that we're trying to avoid. And then, as you mentioned, the length of the maceration is not really directly related to the strength of the tannins or the extraction. The extraction, as we call it, is more a matter of how forceful you are. We try to be extremely gentle, but we do love the long maceration periods because it's the chance to get the tannins to marry together. In scientific words, we'd say polymerize, so get softer. But also for the more subtle aromatics to depart from the skin of the fruit, from the solid of the grape, and be diluted into the wine. That's why we love to go as long as usually 50, 57 days. It really depends on the vintage.
Wow. Yeah.
When possible, we go for long.
Just tell me, I wonder with climate change, how that's affecting Nebbiolo. That Nebbiolo was, you couldn't plant historically over a certain altitude and it tended to be grown on warmer south-facing sites. Are we going to see more Nebbiolo planted at higher altitudes, do you think? Are we seeing that now?
Well, we're already experiencing this. In the last rehaul of the lows of Barolo and Barbaresco, which happened around 2005, some vineyards that previously were not considered to be Barolo and Barbaresco sites have been included into Barolo and Barbaresco. As an example, Serra Denari, that was an MGA that did not exist previously. I don't think we're going to see much more of a growth in elevation for Barolo and Barbaresco. The conversation of the winemaking community these days is whether to open the chance to grow Nebbiolo for Barolo and Barbaresco on the north side of the hills. But that is a complex topic that I think will take time to unfold and really, really understand. It is true that Nebbiolo is showing some sort of resilience, and that allows us to really take the time to research and be thorough in the decisions of the future. So I would say it is a concern, as for everyone. We do have the blessing of not being in an emergency mode yet. It's a pressure on our shoulders, but we feel we have the chance to explore and really be precise and thorough into trying to understand the future of the variety and the sites.
Yeah, so at the moment, these higher vineyards and these north-facing sites tend to be planted with the other grapes, so Dolcetto and Barbera and Fraser and Moscato and all those sorts of things, yeah?
Correct. Or some people already have planted some Nebbiolo for lighter Lange Nebbiolo or Nebbiolo d'Alba, which offers already a bit of a head start into the learning of how Nebbiolo will behave in those sites.
Yeah, and you've talked about this tiny little place, you know, 3 miles by 6 miles. I mean, what's that, sort of 5 kilometers by 8.5 or something like that, that makes these incredible wines from one variety. And it's never really made great things anywhere else. I mean, I've had some quite good things from Argentina, a bit from the King Valley in Australia, a little bit, but not many places. So I just wonder, has anyone ever said to you, Fira family, come and do a joint venture with us somewhere else? And would you do it?
No, Tim, if that had happened, I prefer not to talk. But because it means we didn't go through. But I have immense respect for people trying to plant Nebbiolo in other places of the world. I think it's a beautiful endorsement to the variety. I think it's only passionate people could ever be so crazy to plant Nebbiolo, not being their sort of heritage variety. So kudos to them. And I always taste those wines and approach, and when I have the chance to go visit those vineyards, with immense respect. I'm happy to honor those people making a try.
Which is the best one you've had?
Oh, we have a very, very personal and special connection with Steve Pannell.
Steve would probably be the best, yeah?
And there are other great examples of Nebbiolo. It's not Barolo. It's not Barbaresco. Let me say, thank God, it's not Barolo and Barbaresco. So we do have something to that is still unique to here. But you can just, these wines exude the passion of their growers. Yeah.
And of a brilliant winemaker as well, Steve.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
Where did his grapes come from? Are they McLaren Vale grapes?
Yeah, that I know. There's some vineyards they've been purchasing recently, and that's fantastic news.
Listen, I could talk to you for hours, but the podcast can't go on forever. But tell us a little bit about how you get away from wine. You know, you're still young. You've got a young family as well, 3 kids. If you've got time for yourself, what do you like to do? How do you relax?
Tim, here's the bad news. It's now 4 kids. So
oh, no, you have another one.
I think that answers the question. There's no time to get away. But honestly, it might sound very Italian, if you will, but the time spent with opening up the doors of the house to the extended family, to the friends, that is some of the most meaningful time in life.
Yeah.
And with that comes, friendship, I would say, is is the energy that brings life going and that relieve you from a long day or a long season in the vineyards, in the cellar, mm-hmm. is the good friends who care for you, who understand your work and understand that you're stuck somewhere in the middle of the cellar for maybe 2 months, but you're there, and that kind of friendship just carries all lifelong.
And I should say also to anybody listening to the podcast who wants to go and visit, yours is one of the nicest bodegas or a cantina really to visit in the world, actually. You know, it was a very, very friendly welcome. It's always a lovely place, but you guys are always there. It's still very much a family winery. So anybody listening wants to go, get in touch via the website and sign up to book a tour, yeah?
Grazie. We can't wait to see you all here. Grazie, team.
Okay, thank you. Just say hi to your father and to your family and see you very soon.
Awesome. Take care. Ciao, ciao.
What a brilliant and articulate young man. And I love the idea of the 1990s being Barolo and Barbaresco's teenage years. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the German wine expert and master of wine, Anne Krebiel. Join me then.
Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.